Well, we now get to hear somebody who I know is a very inventive person, Glenn Schneider. He is an astronomer at the Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona. He is and has been for a while the project scientist on an infrared camera on the Hubble Space Telescope, but he does deign to look at brighter things than what Hubble looks at, and does some wonderful analysis of things. I've had the pleasure of seeing some of those. I'm happy to introduce Glenn Schneider.
Thank you, Jay. Running up the stairs and going for an excellent meeting again. Thank you so much. It's been great. I wanted to follow up a bit, and Joel Harris had suggested that some of us are getting a little bit long in the tooth, but I wanted to start out by first saying that I had nothing to do with this flight. This is a bit of a historical chronology, though. Next year will mark the 90th anniversary of the first Eclipse flight. Some people don't necessarily recognize it's gone back that far. I'll speak a bit to that. Joel had suggested that Eclipse Chasing did something about relative to the loss of his hair. I know clouds and weather have grayed mine, which was the motivation for my trying to get up above altitude. It's the one way that you can get above the weather. You don't have to worry about it. So I should say that the first eclipse chase by air was not a recent proposal. It goes back to 1918, and as scientists and astronomers usually do, you end up writing proposals to granting agencies and people who have resources. And John Mills, who wrote a proposal to the Naval Observatory to use an eclipse, use an airplane to observe a total solar eclipse, without much justification other than it would be an interesting thing to do. I should say during the course of this talk, I'm going to fly through it, no pun intended. There's a lot of references to various publications you may want to take a look at, and it'll all be in the proceedings, so you can take a look at that. This really preceded any science, but there was some great prescience in what this established for the future. And this really was the first astronomical event ever to be observed from an airplane. So it is a bit of a groundbreaking an activity. And what was written up about it, the quote on the bottom there, we may eventually look to the aviator for the work of value in connection with eclipses, even though there was no serious scientific objective undertaken here. And keep that in mind as we go through some of this, as we come up to the present. The other thing that was said was it couldn't be imagined that a solid foundation, a solid platform from which to put equipment and mount real science observations can hardly be looked to for even in the planes of the future. And that paradigm was broken, as we'll see, of course. So my top 10 reasons for observing an eclipse from the air, and in particular from the stratosphere, obviously from very early on, even before airplanes, deployment of yourself and your equipment and relocation in the event of bad weather, or other things going on. In this case, Jules Janssen of the Paris Observatory managed to get out of Paris to see the eclipse in 1870 by going by balloon. But cloud obscuration avoidance, getting away from those pesky things down in the lower levels of the Earth's atmosphere, is a great motivator for a lot of people. If you get up into the stratosphere, you're virtually assured of having clear weather. If you get up into the polar stratosphere, not only are you really assured of clear weather, but you get up high enough so you don't have to worry about turbulence and such in the aircraft. Another more recent thing with higher speed aircraft, of course, that goes along with being able to fly high up is high speed that extends the duration of totality. The record for that is 74 minutes with the Concorde flight in 1973. And if you want to observe, sky transparency is spectacular. I'm talking here about stratospheric flights, getting up to altitudes in the polar regions above 8, 10 kilometers, or in the equatorial regions of 11, 12 kilometers, and it's a little bit chancier there. But you get great reduced particulate scattering in the atmosphere. The sky is incredibly dark, so you have very high coronal contrast. You can see the corona out to much larger radii than you can from the ground. The astronomical seeing, basically the quality of the sky, the stability of air cells in the sky, what's measured by a parameter called R-naught, gets smaller as you go up in increasing altitude. Number seven, atmospheric turbidity, basically the vorticity and the shear in the atmosphere, it all declines in power as you go up. Again, you have more stable air that you're looking through. And importantly for science, you get a much more panchromatic view of the solar spectrum. You have greatly improved infrared and ultraviolet windows that open up that allow you to observe at wavelengths that you can't from the ground. And the horizon, just to pick a number, from 35,000 feet, which all commercial aircraft, commercial passenger jets today can pretty much reach, your horizon vista is 367 kilometers away. So it's an amazing view from that distance. And it's fun. So, you know, and you get lots of frequent flyer miles if you do that. So going back a bit, the first flight, actually, the proposal, as I said, the first flight was in 1918. There were a couple of proposals that immediately followed after that. And then the first real expedition was undertaken in 1923. And the coordination of that flight was orchestrated by Captain Stevens, who was an Army officer, but really a pioneer in the field. Not only was he an aerial photographer, he's considered by many the father of airborne astronomy. And he flew a balloon up, way up into the stratosphere, 72,000 feet. He was the first person to actually see the curvature of the Earth. Took the first in situ measurements of the temperature profile in the tropopause. It's fun stuff. I'd love to do it, but well, it's all been done already. So the Navy sent 16 aircraft up in 1924, and the objective was to determine the location of the center line from the air to improve on the lunar ephemeris and future predictions of eclipses. They intended to do aerial. They did aerial photography, planned to expose 30 plates from the air from aircraft very much like this de Havilland, which was one of them that was flown. Unfortunately, it was not successful. They realized that these kind of aircraft are not that stable platform when you're dealing with photographic plates that aren't all that sensitive. So unfortunately, the synopsis of that by a little was that no valuable results were secured, but they learned a lot from that. And one of the things they learned is they needed a more stable platform. So Colonel Millis reproposed the idea to use a dirigible, an airship, and get on the top of it and build a platform and put it on top of something like that and sit there and observe. Well, that's the Navy airship Los Angeles, and it actually did fly, and the reason was to get above coastal clouds in Long Island in New York. Even though they only got up to 4,500 feet, there's a lot of low cloud and fog that they could potentially have been worried about. Couldn't get up very high with it. There are a number of scientific objectives, as you see, including securing photographs and drawings of the corona. They weren't so sure they were going to succeed in the photographic programs, so they carried a couple of artists on board as well. All of these objectives, which I just delineate here, actually were very successful. Here actually is a manual tracking apparatus that you can see that was in the cockpit, and the comment on the bottom was that, well, they realized it wasn't really appropriate to put people on the top of this thing. It wasn't a suitable place for apparatus or personnel. And in fact, the operator of at least one of the instruments had his fingers frozen. Even in the cockpit, it was very cold there. And you see here, this was the motion picture camera results on the right. You can see a few frames from that. This is a spectrograph that was flown in the precursor of what was the National Bureau of Standards and obtained a nice solar spectrum in the chromosphere and the corona. Very low spectral resolution, but they actually managed to do it from the airship. So there was great hopes that they could continue doing this into the future, at least for a while. So the ideas changed about using dirigibles in 1937. But even before that, right near here in 1930, this was a series of eclipses that started, and I love this one because this is an annular total. I kind of object to the term hybrid, but I won't get into that. This is an annular total that was visible from here in Southern California, mid-California, as a total eclipse. The path width was 1.1 kilometers, and the duration was 1.4 seconds without limb corrections applied. So it was a real dicey case here, trying to do this by airplanes. But they realized that if they could nail down the shadow track on this, it could really help improve on lunar ephemeris. And again, that was one of the objectives. So two aircraft were sent up by the Army Corps of Engineers over in the Napa-Sonoma Valley, carrying K-6 aerial cameras. And here you see the camera operator and camera on the aircraft. And they realized also here that if they could get up in altitude, this was the first proposal actually talking about less dust and water vapor and so forth. Unfortunately, and I'll point you to the paper here and the publication of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, they realized that the shadow, what there was of it, was very close, but they realized that they actually didn't get into the umbra here. It was a difficult thing. On the other hand, the Navy succeeded in doing it a little bit further northeast along the path. The Army and the Navy, for those who are not U.S. citizens, are always dickering about things, so they had to send out separate expeditions here. And here it was time-resolved imagery that actually saved the day, and they used this pancake camera, 35-millimeter camera, mounted on back of the airplane, and you can see the platform where the camera is. The camera itself is actually in the Air and Space Museum. You can go and see it and take a look at that. So that was the second of these three solar eclipse flights that was sort of managed by Captain Stevens. And the August 1932 eclipse, they got even more into the idea of getting into higher altitude, and they got 5 miles up, 27,000 feet. Of course, they had to be on oxygen for that, and he operated three cameras successfully, and got time-resolved imaging of the approach to the lunar shadow. So those are the first infrared observations, actually at infrared-sensitized plates that they used in this eclipse. And unfortunately, the third camera got tangled in an oxygen hose, which makes wonderful reading if you dig up this National Geographic article about it. Mm-hmm. I'm advancing forward to the end of the Second World War, where there were lots of war aircraft available from all sides of the Atlantic. And the Royal Canadian Air Force mounted what I consider the real first major scientific multimodal expedition. They were doing spectroscopy, visual infrared photography of the corona and prominences, spectroscopy, and the first polarization measurements. Getting above the dust was critical to really try and improve, or actually get the first polarization measurements of solar eclipse. And they succeeded in doing this quite well. Polarization is kind of a key to understanding a lot of the parameters in the dust parameters of the corona. And this was really exploited in 1954 from a study that was done by Blackwell. Again, I'll point you to the paper in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. And he said that observation should be done in an open aircraft, not through a window, because the scattering will kill you. They didn't have great windows back then on those aircraft, unlike aircraft today. So he wanted to mount the camera, and he did, in an open doorway. Now, this was a Lincoln, a turboprop that was souped up to go to 43,000 feet. I was sitting on a bus the other day with Evan Zucker, if he's still here, who's a jet fighter pilot, and was telling me about the explosive decompressions at altitudes. And they realized this was kind of inadvisable. They probably shouldn't do that, so they limited the flight to 30,000. He was in a pressure suit operating his equipment from 30,000 feet up in their aircraft out the open door in the back of the airplane. See it there. Great fun. Ran eight cameras, one of eight that was shown there, and the specifications in terms of field of view and so forth were there, but the real intent of this was to get polarization measurements. And notice, though, the guiding tolerance was 10 arc minutes over a 1 minute exposure. So it's not spatial resolution. It's getting deep and really dark. And if you look at what you can do, this was at 62 degrees north. And even then, they realize you're getting up into the stratosphere because you're at higher latitudes, just at the top of it, at even 30,000 feet. And if you look at this chart, you're getting to 10 to the minus 11th solar intensity out at 50 degrees. This is a very wide field imager. They didn't only want to get the outer coronal intensity, but the zodiacal light as well. And got the first polarization measurements, measured the polarization of the zodiacal light and the corona at 5 solar radii. And theorized that the corona, perhaps there was some extrapolation into the zodiacal light from measurements that were taken elsewhere. So I won't dwell into that, but it was a very, very successful science mission. It was also the first flight where a UFO was recorded during a total eclipse. This was a commercial flight looking out the anti-sun side window. You can see the lunar umbral shadow on the clouds and what has claimed to be a UFO. And when I did a Google statistics search, there are at least 213 websites out there that talk about this UFO, so you can go read about that. None in the refereed scientific literature, but they're out there. Speed, then, as these aircraft became available in 1955, again, this was this wonderful family of 7-minute eclipses, and this was one of them. The U.S. Air Force used two aircraft that they deployed from the Philippines to chase the eclipse with the express duration of making it longer, and they achieved over a 12-minute duration of totality on this eclipse. Science really pushed forward in the 1960s, and this sort of prescient idea that you can't get a stable foundation, a stable platform in an airplane. NASA used their Convair aircraft as a platform. This was really an atmospheric research aircraft to put in the first gyro-stabilized camera into an airplane, and it flew again on subsequent missions, and this was developed out of NASA Ames, and they achieved several arc-second pointing stability with this gyro control system and really opened up a new age for astronomy and eclipse photography. So the idea that you can't look to airplanes for stable foundation sort of went away. And this really was the golden age of astronomy for solar eclipse observations. Not really because they got these great goggles that came out of this sort of period of time. I don't know if Ralph has approved these or not. But during the Cold War, the Air Force and the Atomic Energy Commission actually had to undertake a program as part of verifying the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. And And in order to do that, the United States Congress, they had this whole test and readiness program, authorized the procurement of three aircraft, which were NC-135 aircraft, basically 707s, to be operated by the three national laboratories here in the United States, Los Alamos, Sandia, and Livermore. And one scientist realized these aircraft would be available. They said, hey, this would be great for studying the ionosphere, magnetic fields, cosmic rays, and solar eclipses. And proposing exactly the same reasons that we've been talking about, getting high above the Earth's atmosphere and so forth, to be able to do infrared observations. And amazingly, the government approved it. And it led to seven expeditions by the three national laboratories from 1965 to 1980 for carrying out observations from these three aircraft that were bought to verify compliance with nuclear treaties. So there was this wonderful device that was built by the guys at Los Alamos called the Rube, or the Rube Goldberg, which was sort of your multifunction do-everything solar eclipse observer. It looked out the window, had two-axis driven motor. There was a photoelectric guider that had a system that actually fed back on a steering mirror to keep things stable. A movie camera that was actually part of the guiding system. Fiber optics that split into photoelectric detectors and interferometers. It was a wonderful thing. You really need to... Art Cox was the principal investigator on this, an inventive guy. Looks like a saguaro. Whoops, looks like a saguaro cactus, which is why I think I like it so much. Is kind of an idea of how the system actually worked. And you can see what it looked like on the aircraft. Another instrument they flew was a spectrometer, really to be able to take advantage of some of the passbands, but also getting up in altitude. And they called it the Holy Cow, because when we wrote the specifications for its spectral capabilities, that was the response from the review committee. And they were actually very, very successful. And for this group, I believe that Don Liebenberg holds the record for the number of minutes of time in the umbral shadow, and I think it's 111 minutes, if I remember correctly. So now he flew on the Concorde and all these other missions, so you can consider that cheating or not. But anyway, I'll point you to his paper. Using the spectrographs, they saw the calcium H and K lines, the calcium 2 and the H and K lines, two solar radii out into the corona, did temperature measurements. All of this was early and got good limb profile measurements, so forth, and just a few photographs from that wonderful series of flights that took us through the 1970s. Here's Art Cox after an exhausting mission in 1973. I have no idea, or at least I had no idea, how anybody could fall asleep on an eclipse flight afterwards, but I kind of knew what he was dreaming about, I think. It was what he might do in the future. Yeah, just some of these that we've done subsequently. I love this quote, though. As the mission proceeded, the one in red, those on the 135, their aircraft, watched in disbelief as the SST streaked by at 55,000 feet. So lots of aircraft deployed for that eclipse, and wonderful people working on it, and it really pushed solar eclipse astronomy. Contemporaneous with that is the record holder and the only manned spacecraft to date that's observed a total solar eclipse, and that was Gemini 12. And this was not a fluke. They actually did two phasing maneuvers using their Agena targeting vehicle. They actually did burns on that to put themselves a little bit of a tweak into the umbra. This photograph was taken by Buzz Aldrin, who some of you may know from other things that he's done. He got the diamond ring, but they actually did go through the umbra, but he didn't get that photograph. So there's a NASA ID there. You can pull it from when you get the conference proceedings if you want a copy of it. Exceedingly short. That's all I can tell you. Exceedingly short. I'm not going to speak a whole lot about the Concorde flight because it is so well recorded in history, other than to say it was 74 minutes across all of Africa, and this was the prototype Concorde. It was outfitted with four special windows that were tailored for the science that was intended to be done during the mission. The mission was to look for far infrared emission from the chromosphere out at long thermal infrared and beyond wavelengths, coronal near infrared emission at mid infrared and shorter infrared wavelengths, time resolved coronal imaging out to 15 solar radii, so forth. But the window system was designed for each of the cameras and it was highly successful. And this chart shows you here why you want to get up to this sort of an altitude, 14 kilometers, particularly at a longer wavelength. This is a comparison to what we can do in white at Mauna Kea, which is a great site on the ground. 1991, of course, went over Hawaii, and on the summit was 4 kilometers up. In the far infrared wavelengths, there is no transparency at all. If you get up to 14 kilometers, the kind of altitudes we're talking about, you open up all these windows in the infrared, and even lots of windows in the shorter wavelength infrared, you get much better transparency even in the optical. The real reason for using aircraft And NASA understood that. And even after this first series, once overlapped with the Atomic Energy Commission flights, NASA launched and procured a dedicated aircraft, which is the NASA Learjet Observatory. That was under Frank Lowe, who you see there on the chart. He built the first very simple telescope. It did some wonderful infrared observations. This was not specifically designed for eclipses. It was a general-purpose small observatory for infrared observations. And again, much like thinking you should observe from an open aircraft, observing from an open aircraft really couldn't be done, but he had an open port, cut a hole in the side of the airplane, and pressure-mounted a telescope to it and used the aircraft itself as a pointing control system. And it worked wonderfully, and it flew many astronomy missions for 15 years or so. And this just, it was used for solar eclipse astronomy, the February 1979 eclipse. The first observations were made really of the extremity of the solar limb at 400 microns at 13 kilometer altitude, and really was looking for very significant, spatially significant 100 kilometer scales back then, inhomogeneities on the lower chromosphere to sort out some differences in theories that had come up from Concorde observations, which turned out not to be correct. So 1979 was sort of a banner year for this. Of course, the KC-130 flight, the 135 flights were going on. This was this Los Alamos radial gradient camera. We heard a lot about radial gradient imagery. They flew one in this aircraft as well. This is an exposure at 40,000 feet. Over 1,000 aircraft were up in the air for this eclipse, at least according to Life magazine. I don't know how authoritative that is, but they reported that 1,000 aircraft over the airspace of the United States for that eclipse, including three of these aircraft, NASA T-38 trainers, which I understand Evan also has flown in one of those. But Steve Hawley and Sally Ride, who you might know, and Hoot Gibson, who I didn't have a picture of, were in training at the time. And Sally and Steve are astronomers. They somehow managed to convince their management that it would be a really neat idea to take these things up and go see the solar eclipse. Their management thought it was a bit of a boondoggle, but they let them do it anyway. They thought it would be a great shuttle training operational exercise. So it was just a plain neat thing to do. No real science on this, much like the 1918. It was a training exercise for what they might do with the space shuttle later on. So, interesting concept. Following that, the next aircraft by NASA was the Kuiper Airborne Observatory. Again, a general purpose observatory, infrared optimized. You can see the telescope there. The side of the aircraft opens up. It's a 92 centimeter telescope from 1 to 500 microns, and it too was pushed into service for solar eclipse observations. This paper in the Astrophysical Journal, Eric Becklin, some of you may or may not know, he is now the chief scientist for the SOFIA mission. So he's been in airborne astronomy for a long time. Great science has come out of this. I'll point you to this particular paper. It was the first results. They called it a lunar occultation before they got in totality at observations from 30 to 200 microns during the eclipse. And they found the solar limb to be extended at longer wavelengths, and they were looking at different chromospheric models, again, with spatial resolutions of 1,000 kilometers or so from these observations. Unfortunately, the chief pilot for Kuiper died just a couple of weeks after this, flying a test mission, not with this aircraft, but another one. So that paper in the Astrophysical Journal was dedicated to him, and it's the only one that I know of in the referee literature, modern referee literature, with a dedication of such. And it kind of reminds us that these aircraft experimental missions, you still have to worry about them a little bit. But we move into the era then of what I call egalitarian eclipse flights, because the 1970s, people used aircraft to relocate, which was so presciently put forth by Carly Simon. I won't sing that to you. But here's a flight out of Perth, Australia, for the 1974 eclipse, some photographs by Wendy Carlos. Seat stripped out, people put on the windows, wonderful picture of the shadow approaching from up above, and the coronal photography that she had gotten through the aircraft. I think that was her telescope picture of it there on the window. So this sort of began, hey, not just scientists and NASA, everybody can kind of do eclipse flights of one sort or another. And we heard, of course, about the canon of solar eclipses by Jiméus, Grosjean, and van der Leen. And what caught my attention at very, well, right after it was published in 66, was this wonderful eclipse that he highlighted that had his duration of 0 seconds in his canon. Which I thought, wow, that's got to be great. 0 seconds has got to be really interesting. Talk about bead and edge phenomena, right? I mean, you know, how do we do that? Here's what the path looks like by Fred Espenak. You can see it was this little tiny narrow horseshoe, which was total, only sort of in this region. Let me blow that up by a factor of 20 so you can get an idea. You can tell me where the totality is in there, or annularity, or hybridicity, or whatever you want to call it. But it would be a very, very interesting eclipse, and it reminded me so much of this one that they try to do for 1.4 seconds, but this one was zero. So we attempted to do this, and we did it in a Citation II aircraft. Nine of us, John Beattie, who's here in the audience also, was on that airplane. Fred recomputed it 15 years later and actually said, no, it was minus 2 seconds. It really wasn't total. But I'll show you what we saw, and you can argue about it. I don't care what you call it. It was neat. We went up 44,000 feet. Getting up 44,000 feet actually got us 80 kilometers closer to the moon. It grew the moon's diameter by 7/10 of an arc second, which gave us a little bit of an edge. Alan Fiella at the Naval Observatory provided us with the latest the updates, basically, in the limb profiles. And at that time, there were no laptop computers, so we had to pre-compute the path, which was a problem, because of the imponderables about what atmospheric refraction models would you use. Clearly, we were going to use these limb correction models. Depending upon the refraction model you use, we figured it was 1.9 arc seconds of arc minutes of refraction towards the zenith, but there was uncertainty in that. There was no GPS back then. We had to worry about gyro bias errors and so forth, but we managed to get in the path of whatever you call this thing. And it was quite an amazing event. And that was sort of my introduction to airborne eclipses. But back in the egalitarian flights, lots of other flights were being launched for lots of people to see solar eclipses. Joe Rayo here scoured commercial airline flights. This actually, I think, is a chartered company, but they had regularly scheduled flights. Managed to convince them to delay a flight by 41 minutes, and 360 passengers got to see 71 seconds in totality, just almost serendipitously. Except I understand most of them complained when a few of the eclipse chasers tried raising their windows during the movie. They didn't like that idea. And these photographs are from Fred Espenek. That same eclipse, I think there were, and please correct me, I think there were actually three jet aircraft that were launched from Finland on this. And this is one of the three, that and Fred's airplane, and I'm trying to see who else is in the picture there. But 90 people aboard that aircraft, and you can see Fred's picture of the eclipse from there at 32,000 feet. Now, lots of people have said the Hubble Space Telescope can't see a solar eclipse. Well, sort of yes and no. It actually flew through the umbra of the 1991 total solar eclipse. It was absolutely amazing. The velocity vector of the telescope was basically in the same direction as the umbra, and it went through with an antiumbral depth of 95%. So it actually saw 1 minute and 4 seconds of totality. And we know that it did because we did some observations of it off the solar arrays and watched the charging cycle. So here's the day-night cycle. Here's day, charging the batteries, trickle, nighttime, day, trickle, nighttime, whoops. And it was the total solar eclipse seen by Hubble. So there actually is such an observation. Moving forward, the next year, 1992, and we had just heard of an unfortunate cloud out on the coast of either northern Brazil or southern Uruguay. The probability of seeing that eclipse from the ground was less than 5%. So if there are any Calvin and Hobbes fans in here, we decided to take an airplane up for that one, a DC-10. And by this time, we actually had portable computers that we could put to work on this, and I had put together the first sort of high-precision moving platform dynamical computation feed into the aircraft navigation system software. It's too much to say. It's called eFlight, and it was on a Macintosh running APL. And we used it on the aircraft, and a bunch of people in here, including myself, used it to go out and see the eclipse over the South Atlantic at an altitude of 41,000 feet, but it just put us just at the top of the, right at the tropopause, because we were so low, and it was a very bouncy flight. So you really need to pick and choose your flights, if indeed you do want stability, and they need to be polar flights. Polar flights are absolutely wonderful. So the pirates took over the airplane, and we managed to see that eclipse. So, and yes, you can fall asleep. It was exhausting. Now I understood how Art fell asleep after that, and I had the same dream that Art did. You know, it was like, so, and we did 2001 we didn't do, 2003 we did, and we're going to do 2008 next year. So, into the 1990s, is the Wild Blue Yonder higher, faster, longer? It's sort of like better, cheaper, faster, whatever NASA calls it, but it was breaking the Mach barrier with some wild and wacky flights with MiGs that became available after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And supersonic was the way to go. This was not for people yet, or I should say individual people. The record holder for this was the 1995 eclipse over India, where MiG-25 went up to 80,000 feet, and Mach 2.5 saw the eclipse, and it's just an absolutely unparalleled altitude where the sky just went just absolutely incredibly dark. I think this record's going to stand for quite a while. So that's MIGs, I said, were used during this. There were a couple of other expeditions. I should point out that actually from the University of Sofia, they had mounted a ground and air offensive to do combined optical infrared imagery, which was very successful up at 13,000 feet, flying at about Mach 2 from the aircraft. This is part of a program called the NOTA project. It's Neutrino Oscillation Telescope, specifically for solar eclipses. And you can see the camera platform being mounted into the MiG-29, ready for flight. Unfortunately, they didn't get off the ground. The weather was bad, and they would have had to have landed back in the area of operations in Romania near the airbase. They couldn't land in another country because it was a military aircraft, so they never got permission to take off. Mm-hmm. So this unfortunately didn't go. 1999, there were a flock of Concords that went out, three of them, two from British Airways, one from Air France, to go see the eclipse. This was an absolutely horrible eclipse to do a Concorde. I'm sorry if anybody here flew the Concorde. I hope you got a good view. I haven't heard great reports on it. The geometry of the eclipse was not right for doing this as an intercept. You can kind of see that by the crazy paths here. Some of the passengers, quotes from some of the passengers, as before takeoff, there was rehearsal of the seat switching that had to be performed again on the left side and then switch back and so forth. And that probably should have worked okay. Wonderful views from the cockpit if you happen to be up there, of course. They did get their free drinks and approved solar glasses back then. But there was a stunning view of the partial eclipse, but it wasn't so easy to see, appearing quite small and so high in the sky that many people were on their knees between their own seats and one in front and twisting their necks around and peering out the tiny windows. And totality was something it seemed only the lucky ones were able to witness. And another quote here that, you know, somebody saw 10 seconds of totality. So I'm hoping more people. I've had a lot of negative reports on that one. But 2001 would have been a spectacular eclipse to do by the Concorde. We actually had an agreement in place with Air France to launch a flight from Ascension Island. We would have gotten nearly an hour of totality with very good viewing for that particular eclipse. The shadow velocity actually dropped below the cruise velocity of the Concorde for quite some time. And we were ready to go with this when fate stepped in and the Concorde fleet became grounded. And so we ended up not doing that flight. The record holder, by the way, this I think is the most glorious picture of the solar corona, although the spatial resolution is awful. It's actually the zodiacal dust in the corona into one. This is taken from the Clementine spacecraft. This is not an aircraft thing. But this is the record holder. This is a mosaic of seven images, and it is a solar eclipse because you can see there's one of the seven images where the moon is occulting the sun, and you can see the corona and the zodiacal dust. And you put it back together, and I think this is a marvelous, marvelous picture, and that's how you want to do polarimetry from space. So 2003, I think everybody knows, there are actually three flights that were done in the Antarctic, two that housed lots of eclipse chasers, just finishing up, Jay. There was a flight that went over two different parts of the continent, so they didn't interfere with each other. Again, it was flown by eFlight, a closed-loop dynamical control system with the aircraft, at least on the 747. The other was manually flown. It placed eclipse chasers in the path of totality over Antarctica from the high reaches of the polar north. And wonderful. All of those 10 reasons is exactly why you wanted to do that. And yes, you can get good high-resolution imagery of solar eclipses from airplanes through windows. A little bit of image processing magic that we've all seen during the course of this conference. The Japanese actually flew the first real-time downlink, high-definition TV of a solar eclipse as part of an education and public outreach program. And this is sort of the chronological history of these flights, getting above 2 kilometers or more above the tropopausal boundary, where you have no concerns about clouds and wonderful transparency. Sofia will provide us a science capability once it starts flying. Eric Becklin's the chief scientist on that. He has the most experience with open cockpit flying. He was on the Aloha Airlines. He was on this flight, and so they made him the director designee for Sofia. As a result of that, last year, it was completely defunded by the White House, but I'm happy to say it was a reprieve. It's back in. We had first flight of Sofia just this year. We'll be starting science operations next year. It won't be solar-enabled in time for any of the eclipses we're worried about, unfortunately. So we'll close the gap with another egalitarian flight coming up for the next eclipse. We're going to launch a flight up over to about latitude 82 degrees north. Get about 3 minutes of totality, and that will sit right over here, 2 to 3 kilometers, way above the tropopause into the stratosphere. And I had a poster up. If anybody saw it, this will just convince you that this is the place that you want to be. If you want to get above weather, pick a polar eclipse. The next one after this will probably be 2015 for a flight. This is where we're going to do it, in this region between Greenland and Svalbard. And the reasons for doing it, as I've talked to before, the increase in the duration of totality. It's perfectly placed out the airplane window between 20 and 25 degrees up. And the last thing I'll say before Jay kicks me off is that, much like the 2003 eclipse, we fielded a collaborative imaging experiment with a gyro-stabilized platform on that aircraft using the observer window in the flight deck. We're going to do the same here. So if people have a particular idea, concept, and want to collaborate on an imaging platform to fly in the flight deck, whether you're on this flight or not, contact me, because this is the year that we're going to define what that is and put that together. My website's there. I have nothing to do with the commercial end of this, but if you want to get on the flight, that's the website for that. And that's 90 years in 33 minutes. I'm 3 minutes over.
Twice as long, but Patrick wouldn't have stood for that. But if everybody had talked at the speed that Glenn talks, we would have had a one-day meeting. But so let me ask for a quick question or two. Yes?
On the MiG flight, how long did they extend totality?
The MiG-29 flight?
Yeah. In 95.
I will actually have to look that up. I think it was on the chart. I don't want to give you the wrong number.
It said 90 seconds.
I think that's right, because that was a very short eclipse. They did it over India. It was an Indian mission, and on the ground, so totality on center line was...
And you said it was a record, so I thought...
It was a record in altitude, not a record in speed.
Okay.
So, yeah, on the ground, it was around 50 seconds. They about doubled the duration of totality.
Or was it a land speed?
Very quick, Craig.
Yeah. I heard that there's... still one Concorde that's in flight-ready condition. Are you aware of that?
I've heard rumors.
Okay. If you had, I just wondered whether you thought there might be some future eclipse that could be adapted to be used for.
Well, I do now.
Well, yes, Xavier knows about it. In fact, Duncan's working on it.
And it's maintained only, you know, by animals.
Well, as we...
You never fight again because, you know, it won't be a road.
As we near the... Thank you very much, Glenn. Thank you.